Greetings. You're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society is an interdisciplinary group of Christian scholars devoted to the study of tradition, place, and things divine. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, and to sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, ciceroniansociety.org. My name is Ethan Alexander Davey. I'm a professor of political science at Campbell University and a member of the board of directors of the Ciceronian Society. We will begin with a prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Glory to thee, our God, glory to thee, O heavenly King, the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, who art everywhere present and fillest all things, treasury of blessings and giver of life. Come and abide in us, and cleanse us from every impurity, and save our souls, O good one. Amen. Our guest today is Dr. Glenn Cronin. Glenn, welcome back to The Sower. It's good to see you.
It's nice to be here, Ethan. Thank you.
So I'll just remind our listeners a little bit about Glenn. He has a PhD in Russian studies from University of London. His first book, The Disenchanted Wanderer, the Apocalyptic Vision of Konstantin Leontiev, was published in 2021 by Cornell University Press. And this was the subject of our episode number 50 of The Sower. Today, we're going to discuss his second book, The Enduring Enigma of Lev Tikhomirov, published in November of 2025, also by Cornell University Press. Now, as we mentioned in episode 50, both of these Russian figures, Leontiev and Tikhomirov, are almost entirely unknown outside the West. Sorry, outside of Russia, they're almost entirely unknown in the West. So I asked Glenn last time to give us a very brief sketch of Tikhomirov's life and significance. So I'll just take a moment to reiterate what he told us, and he can add things if he likes. So as I understand it, the enigma of Lev Tikhomirov is that he began his career as a revolutionary. He was the chief theorist and writer for Narodnaya Volya, the People's Will, which was the revolutionary terrorist group that assassinated Tsar Alexander II. After the assassination of the Tsar, Tikhomirov was forced to flee abroad, where ultimately he had a Damascene conversion. He renounced revolutionary ideology and methods and petitioned Tsar Alexander III to return home to Russia. His petition was granted, and when he returned home, he became one of the most prominent defenders of Russian monarchy and Orthodox Christianity, publishing dozens of articles and several books. When the Bolsheviks eventually came to power, they had his books burned. But since 1991, all of them, or almost all of them, have been republished in Russia. And speaking of the republication of his works, I wanted to show off a couple of these volumes, which I happened to purchase the last time I was in Russia. So here is probably his best-known work, at least in Russia, Monarchическая государственность, Monarchical Statehood. And this one, I don't remember what I paid for this, but it seems a pretty expensive edition. It has full-color illustrations and also black and white illustrations throughout the text. So a very nice edition of this, republished in whatever year this was, probably around the 2016. That's the date on this one. So that's one. And then we have Rukovodyashchie Idei Russkoi Zhizni, The Guiding Ideas of Russian Life, a collection of articles by Tikhomirov. Christianstvo i Politika. By the way, I'm sure there's at least one version of this podcast that will have video, so this is not a total waste of time. This one has, among other articles, Апокалипсическое учение о судьбах и конце мира, The Apocalyptic Teaching about the Fate and End of the World, and В последние дни, Эсхатологическая фантазия, In the Last Days, eschatological fantasy. So these are texts that Glenn talks about in detail in the third part of the book. I'm not quite done yet. Rossiya i Demokratia, Russia and Democracy, another collection of essays, which includes his essay about why he gave up being a revolutionary. And I believe there's an English translation of this collection. And finally, Religiozno-filosofskie osnovy istorii, the religious philosophical foundations of history, Tikhomirov's last major work on the relationship of religion and philosophy to history, which again is the focus of the third part of Glenn's book. So now, can you guess, Glenn, how many of these books I've read?
All of them, I should imagine.
I'm afraid not a single one, but I know you have. I know you've read them all.
Well, I'm envious of you there, Ethan, because I don't have any of these books. I did all my work ruining my eyesight on the internet, I'm afraid. But they're very impressive collection you've got there.
Yes, well, you have convinced me with your book that I ought to read them, that they are worth reading and engaging with. So I don't know when I'll do that, but you've definitely convinced me that I should. All right, I don't know. Is there anything else you'd like to add to the biographical sketch at the beginning?
No, that's pretty goes pretty to the root of it all, I think. Yes,
okay.
I guess we'll come to particular points as we go through.
Okay, very good. All right, so Glenn's book is in part a biography of Tikhomirov, and the biographical parts read like a novel. And that's some of the reviewers say that, and I would agree, particularly the parts about his career as a revolutionary. So I'd actually like to try to avoid giving too many spoilers to the listeners. They should read the book and experience the dramatic twists and turns themselves. Excuse me. But I wanted to ask about a few moments. So first, as you explain in the book, there was nothing especially unusual about Tikhomirov's upbringing. His parents, by all accounts, were Orthodox Christians and patriotic, loyal Russian subjects. So where did the revolutionary fervor come from? What kind of environment did Tikhomirov encounter when he went off to college and then university?
Well, yes, you're quite right. He was born near the Black Sea in the Caucasus at a time when there was a lot of unrest from the local tribes. And his father was a military doctor, and they spent a lot of time traipsing around between military posts. His upbringing was very strongly monarchist and Orthodox Christian. And he went to school, grammar school in Kerch, with a rather naive outlook, which came into conflict immediately with the prevailing spirit of the age, which in the 1860s is best remembered as summed up by Turgenev in his novel Fathers and Sons as nihilism. What was nihilism? It didn't mean, I mean, literally it means nothingism, but in fact the adherents of nihilism actually believed very fervently in a lot of things. But basically, it was that the Russian polity was founded on unfairness and oppression. And they believed that it was the duty of every right-thinking young man to oppose this in every way he could, and not give comfort to what they regarded as a corrupt and unjust society. Of course, this is exactly the opposite of the way that Tikhomirov had been brought up to believe in Russia. I'll just who were the main proponents? Well, the best-known ones are Nikolai Chernyshevsky, the author of the famous book What Is to Be Done. His colleague Nikolai Dobrolyubov on the journal Sopramenik, which was the contemporary, which was the epicenter of the nihilist outlook. But above all, Dmitry Pisarev, who probably had the greatest influence on the youth of the day. And to give you a flavour of what was going on, I'll just quote one or two things that Pisarev said. He recommended his adherents, for example, to, as he said, hate with a great and sacred hatred that enormous mass of petty and rotten stupidities, which prevent the ideas of the good, the true, and the beautiful from clothing themselves in flesh and becoming reality. What can be smashed, he said, must be smashed. Whatever withstands the blow is fit to survive, and what flies into pieces is rubbish anyway. In any case, strike out right and left, no harm can come of it. Now, obviously, this is complete facer for Tikhomirov, and it really put his mind into a turmoil during his time at school, and he had difficulty reconciling the outlook of Pizarro with his upbringing. He thought that when he got to university in Moscow, that somehow the atmosphere there would reconcile these two things. He'd find a way through, but he didn't. Basically, he was very disappointed with the university, and he drifted slowly into revolutionary circles, first in small university societies, but then he got involved with something called the Tchaikovsky Circle. Nothing to do with the composer. It was a mildly revolutionary circle of intellectuals who engaged mostly in propaganda among the workers, the growing industrial proletariat. But unfortunately for him, he was found with some suspect literature in his possession and was arrested and spent 4 years in jail awaiting trial. And I guess that was a finishing school for him, because when he came out, he was firmly convinced that Russia was in need of urgent repair, and the only way to do it was through a revolution. And that's where he set out on the road to the people's will. Yes.
So it occurred to me when I read this this part of the book about his what he experienced at university and then how he got involved in revolutionary activities. This is no very deep insight, but just from some of my other reading, I have a biography of Robespierre, and there's an account of one of the teachers at the one of the people who was aware of his pathway from the college in Paris, Louis le Grand, where Robespierre attended. And this fellow, the Abbé Prieur, gives this account of how Robespierre emerged from that environment. Prior insisted that Louis the 16th had been effectively dethroned before even becoming king by a godless and subversive generation nurtured in the Parisian colleges. And he wrote a retrospective diatribe about this. So I'll just read a couple parts of this. He says, "Remember that it is the educational establishment called Louis le Grand, from which you are today expelling the Jesuits, that will send forth 25 years from now, furies armed with torches to burn their country, firebrands who will sound the tocsin against kings and their ministers. And it is from this establishment that there will come in human form a more atrocious being than any known to the barbarism of antiquity, who, after having more than anyone else determined the murder of his king, will himself rule over you and yours by daggers and assassinations, and will drink the blood of 1 million men. His execrable name will be Robespierre." And then a much shorter line from Thomas Hobbes, whom we may discuss a little bit later. Thomas Hobbes said about the role of the universities in sparking the English Civil War. He said this in his book, Behemoth, quote, "The universities have been to this nation as the wooden horse was to the Trojans." That's quite a line. Although I'm not sure I entirely trust Hobbes's judgment on that, but it's certainly an interesting claim.
Well,
So,
it's
and
certainly,
go ahead.
sorry, Ethan, I was going to say, it's certainly the case that Tikhomirov recalls that when he was at school and university, he couldn't find a single teacher who was prepared to defend the existing polity, or to defend orthodox religion. So This cycle seems to repeat itself over and over. I agree, yes.
Yes. And so no, I hope I suppose I should mention or say that not all universities are Trojan horses for evolution. Like I hope I think I'm pretty sure my university is not that, but this phenomenon we do see this phenomenon repeat itself. All right, so moving along, when Tikhomirov returns to Russia, he publishes an article called "Why I Ceased to Be a Revolutionary." And I'll mention for our listeners that there is an English translation of that work, and we'll put a link in the show notes. That would probably be a good place to start for anyone who wants to read Tikhomirov. So, can you tell us what are some of the major reasons he gives for renouncing revolution?
Well, yes, Ethan, I agree. It's a good thing because it's one of the very few things by Tikhomirov that's so far been published in English. It is a bit like starting in the middle, in a way, because it's the very fulcrum on which his whole life turns, really, is this as you can say, Damascene conversion. Yes, he had a difficult time when he was in immigration. When he was in exile, he was losing faith in the revolutionary creed and struggling to find a way forward. And eventually he seems to have become sickened, actually, by his revolutionary colleagues. His basic thesis was that revolution, and particularly terrorist revolution, was a pointless and superfluous activity. As he said, if the revolutions have the means to overthrow the state, they don't need terror. And if they don't have the means, then it's futile. It won't work anyway. But he said, in spite of that, he said in Russia that the revolutionary credo, in fact, the duty of every good liberal, is rebellion and protest and overthrow of the existing order, often without too much thought of what's going to replace it. He also had a lot to say about the terrorist mentality, and I think that's very significant for us today. He called the terrorist an outsider, what he called a hunted wolf. He said that the terrorists in Russia had striven mightily for years, but had not produced much of a sympathetic reaction in the population at large. Although, I mean, they had a lot of sympathizers among the intelligentsia, but of course they were only a very small fraction of the total Russian population. And under such conditions, Tikhomirov argued, the only thing left to the terrorist is a one-man rebellion. As he said, for that, you don't need the support of anybody. You don't need the support of the country. All you need is your conviction, and you're determined to perish for the cause. He said the romantic delusions of terrorism reach their apogee, of the revolution, reach their apogee in the terrorist mind, and the grip on reality becomes lost. And the world is seen only through the prism of theory, what he called the crazed fervor of the fanatic, who does not allow of doubt, and who sees any discussion as cowardice and baseness. His particular target in this, in why I ceased to be a revolutionary, was the grand old man of revolutionary ideas in Russia, Pyotr Lavrov. The author of the famous historical letters. And Tikhomirov was quite cutting about him. He said his propaganda is soaked, he said, in the pure-blooded spirit of Jesuitism, in which there is absolutely no respect for the thoughts, conscience, and the freedom of others, whether this means other individuals or 100 million people. And if people didn't accept the rightness of Lavrov's worldview, Tikhomirov argued, well, they'll be compelled to. They'll be compelled to by force, and that all they hold sacred will be destroyed. As it reminds me of what you were just saying about Robespierre, by the dagger or dynamite. Basically, this set the tone for Tikhomirov's remaining work throughout the remaining, what, 40 years of his life. He found work afterwards on the Russian conservative newspaper, Luzhniki, and wrote many articles actually warning Russian society about the kind of society which would emerge should the fanatics, should the terrorists ever actually win. Which is something he called a universal slavery, which we might come on to later, so I won't go into that too much now. But yes, I would recommend this to any of your readers who are interested in Tikhomirov, because it really gives the flavour of a man who has had a Pauline conversion and is filled with a burning desire to transmit this to his colleagues before it's too late.
So you've described his analysis of the flaws in the revolutionary mentality, but as your book indicates, there are also some important personal factors in Tikhomirov's decision to renounce revolution. So his wife Katya seems to loom pretty large, and I also thought your comparison of Katya Tikhomirova and Sofia Pirovskaya, Tikhomirov's co-conspirator in the People's Will and also one-time love interest, I thought that comparison was especially interesting. And there's also was the illness and recovery of his son and the answer he discovered in Acts 7:10. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of those personal factors as well.
Yes, Ethan. Well, I'm quite pleased, really, that people are saying that the book reads like a novel, because I've tried to make it accessible, not just a dry academic tome. And I've tried to bring the personal aspects a little bit to the fore, in particular his wife, Katya, Yekaterina Sergeyevna, as she was. Played an enormous role in his life, and really, she's hardly been noticed by writers before, or only in passing. She was a member of the People's Will, although she wasn't a very active member, I have to say. And clearly, they fell in love, and well, they stayed together for 40 years and had four children. And she went into exile with him. In fact, she's the one who put the idea of going abroad into his head, because he was on the run after the assassination of the Tsar and would probably have been executed had he been caught, because although he didn't play an active role in the assassination itself, he was well known as the chief theorist, and in fact had written the what was called the program of the Executive Committee of the People's Will, which was essentially a fatwa on the Tsar's life. So he would have been very much for the high jump. Anyway, she got him to go abroad to Switzerland. She actually got the passports for them, and they went. And I think while he was in exile, she must have played a big role in convincing him that he was in a dead end where he was, and I think she played a prominent role in getting him to apply for clemency to the Tsar to go back to Russia. Perovskaya was a totally different kettle of fish. She's very famous in revolutionary circles. She was actually executed for her part in the assassination of Alexander II, and she was definitely one of the chief movers. And he first met Perovskaya while he was in jail, and they had a kind of affair, which is difficult to know how far it went. But certainly, one of the strange things about the Russian jail at the time was that the prisoners were given privacy if they had female visitors who could show some connection to them. But it appears that actually what Perovskaya had in mind was that she wanted to go to Siberia to try and arrange the escape of certain exiles. And she thought getting Tikhomirov in tow would actually facilitate that. So she was really using him. And they had a big falling out when he got out of jail. And over a failed attempt to break one or two prisoners from jail, and the scales fell from his eyes, really. He saw that Perovskaya wasn't really right for him, and then Katya came along, and really that was that. What did he say about it? He says, after he met Katya, Perovskaya began to seem for me not a woman but a man. Now I saw a real feminine person, a female, not masculine qualities, a joyous outlook on life, and so on and so forth. And basically, he was a gone guy then, and they were together for 40 years after that. And she was, in my opinion, the biggest single influence on his adult life. Oh, you also mentioned Sasha. Yeah, his son Sasha. He had four children. Sasha was the eldest son, I believe. But as a boy, he got in Paris. He contracted meningitis and very, very nearly died. It was a very bad time for Tikhomirov and for Katya. They left Paris and went to the country for a while. I think Sasha recovered, and I think that was very instrumental in Tikhomirov recovering his religious faith. Without being too kind of psychological about it, you could argue that revolutionary faith had supplanted religious faith in Tikhomirov, and now religious faith resupplanted the revolutionary faith. But at any rate, he certainly recovered his Orthodox faith, and it never left him for the rest of his life. And it must have been a big part of his decision to renounce revolution and return to Russia.
And that psychological analysis itself would be consistent with the way Tikhomirov himself explains these phenomena, right? Of course, I suppose we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Well, yeah, I mean the big argument, the big bone of contention about Tikhomirov in Russia. There's not been much written about him in the West hitherto, and is whether he had one life or two. Because I'll give a plug here to a very good book on Tikhomirov by Oleg Milevsky and Alexander Rybnikov called Two Lives of Tikhomirov, Tikhomirova. And it's perfectly understandable why they say that, because it does certainly appear to be a before the reversal and an after reversal life. But you can also argue that there was only one Tikhomirov, really, and it just he just went through various transformations. I think there probably was only one, actually. That his the great thing he wanted to do was he wanted to do something for Russia. And I think, first of all, he saw that he thought that the only way to cure Russia's ills was through revolution, and then he decided that that won't work. That's a dead end. How are we going to do it? So he thought, well, then we'll have to do it through autocracy. There's no third way, and that's where he went for the rest of his life.
Well, speaking of autocracy, that's the next question. So, yeah, so that's what I'd like to turn to next is his writings on monarchy. Now, this is obviously a huge topic. Tikhomirov defended Russia's traditional form of government. The English word for it is autocracy. The Russian word is samodержавие. In an autocratic state, all political power is vested in the Tsar, and he may, according to custom, periodically summon the estates and request their advice. But in the end, the Tsar decides. Now, as you note in the book, when a 21st century person hears this, he is likely to say that such a government is the essence of tyranny. So he might think of Stalin or Hitler or other 20th century dictators and tyrants. As it happens, the men's literature group at my church has been reading Solzhenitsyn's novel, In the First Circle, which features Stalin as a character. And Solzhenitsyn's Stalin is like the tyrants described by medieval Christian writers whose first mistake, which puts them on the path to tyranny, is that they believe that they're God. So, and that's also something that I hope we'll discuss later, because as you've shown, both Leontief and Tikhomirov predicted the emergence of figures like this, Stalin and Hitler. Anyway, there's that association that modern readers will have, that autocracy, that just means tyranny, right? Our 21st century listener, if he studied a little history, might also think of Thomas Hobbes' book, Leviathan, or The Regime of Francis Louis XIV, which are also both reference points in your book. So maybe let's start with the pre-20th century regimes. According to Tikhomirov, there is a difference between autocracy and absolutism, and we can discern this difference both philosophically and historically. So how is Russian autocracy different from absolutism in Tikhomirov's conception?
Well, he was very aware of the problem. I mean, it's not just the 21st century reader who will think this. Plenty of people in his day thought the same. I mean, autocracy for many Russian intellectuals, most of them probably, meant despotism. Tikhomirov's very careful to distinguish between autocracy, some of the Zhalyu, as you say, and some of Vlastye, or despotism, and or absolutism. I mean, he goes to great length and many, many pages to argue that the identification of autocracy and absolutism or tyranny is misconceived. But basically, though, what he comes down to is that the autocrat is not independent. He is not self-sufficient. The autocrat is dependent for his power on God, on the divine sanction. Whereas the despot, the absolutist ruler, like Louis XIV, is dependent on nothing and no one but himself. And in Tikhomirov's view, an autocratic regime will be beneficial because both the ruler and the ruled are acting in accordance with God's ordinance. Whereas an absolutist regime is bound at the end of the day to rely on force to quell opposition. It's interesting about Hobbes because there's a lot of similarities between Tikhomirov and Hobbes, actually. I won't go through them all now, but essentially, though, they can both lay claim to being the first in their relative in their respective polities to set out a theory of the state and state power in quite such detail as they do. And having said that, though, I mean, Tikhomirov was fervently against Hobbes because he saw Hobbes' social contract as being devoid of the divine sanction which would distinguish the ruler, the autocratic ruler, from the absolutist. In fact, he agreed very much with what the Moscow University professor of his day, Alexeyev, said in describing Hobbes as an evangelist of absolutism. Now, I don't know if that's quite fair, but that's certainly something that Tikhomirov would have agreed with. Tikhomirov's view is obviously coming close to a theocratic view of the world. And in fact, he drew quite heavily on the example of Old Testament Israel for his scheme of how the monarch eventually comes to be chosen by God, and the people accept God's choice rather than, as Hobbes would have had it, that they make their own choice. Basically, they give up their wills to the ruler. Tikhomirov says no. In a divinely ordinated autocracy, the people give up their wills to God, and the ruler is chosen essentially by God. One of the things that will certainly strike a 21st century reader as very curious indeed is that for his ideal monarch, Tikhomirov chooses Ivan IV, known familiarly as the Terrible, and that must have struck his contemporaries as rather odd as well. But what he majors on actually is Ivan's philosophical views, basically, that he was ordained by God to rule, not by what he himself, in his correspondence with Kurbsky, called the ever mutable will of man. I mean, it's a risky comparison, I agree, but it does at least bring into focus Tikhomirov's essential view of autocracy as opposed to absolutism. And unfortunately for him, of course, his book, Monarchical Statehood, was published in 1905 at the time of the first Russian Revolution. And I'm afraid he saw Nicholas II acting very much more like an absolutist despot than like his view of an autocrat. And that probably explains why Tikhomirov spent much of the rest of his life developing his other long work, which you mentioned, the religious philosophical fundamentals of society, because he could see that unless Russia recovered its spiritual authority, then I'm afraid the secular authority was rather going to the dogs. I think that probably is enough on that for me for the moment.
I wanted to actually, the first thought I had is about Tsar Ivan IV. When I studied in Russia, I took some courses on Russian history, and the phrase that I kept hearing about Ivan IV was "неоднозначная фигура," an ambiguous figure. So he had
Yes.
some very interesting characteristics. There's the tyrannical part, but also the part that contained that ideal that I suppose Tikhomirov is talking about. But yes, it's difficult to make an argument from probably from that figure. I wanted to read a passage from your book about Tikhomirov's conception of monarchy. This is on page 118. So you're right. For Tikhomirov, the people call on God to give them a supreme ruler who will embody the moral essence of the nation and thus reflect the will of God on earth. And the next is a quotation from Tikhomirov. In one form or another, he argues, the supreme power expresses the spirit of the people, their ideals and beliefs, what they feel inwardly to be the highest principle, worthy of their submission throughout life. As its highest manifestation, this principle is autocratic and unlimited. The supreme power thus created is limited only by the content of its own ideal. So I thought that was interesting for a number of reasons. And of course, you can question how well it's realized in reality. And as I remember from reading your book, Tikhomirov is quite critical in his letters of Tsar Nicholas II, of his incompetence. But that passage about how a proper autocracy can better represent the spirit of the people than the alternative is interesting because especially today we see in many European countries, including Britain, I think right now, the view that the political class, that the political parties don't represent the will of the people or the spirit of the people. And it doesn't matter which party you choose or which party you elect, you always get the same thing. And as a consequence, those parties are collapsing now, it seems to be, but both in Britain and many other European countries. So this idea that monarchy or this kind of monarchy could somehow better represent the spirit of the people than a professional political class. Well, that's also a theme that Tikhomirov develops later on as well. Now, it also, if you'll indulge me, Glenn, for our listeners, if you ask anyone in the Anglosphere who the most famous theorist of monarchy is, Hobbes would almost certainly be the answer. I think that's unfortunate. And of course, I do see the parallels that you draw between Hobbes and Tikhon Mirov. But it seems to me a better English equivalent for Tikhon Mirov might be Edward Hyde, the Earl of Clarendon. Of course, there's no exact equivalent because the English and Russian monarchical traditions are different. But so Clarendon wrote a multi-volume history of the rebellion and civil wars in England about the rebellion of Parliament against Charles I in the 17th century. And he also wrote a book refuting Hobbes's arguments in Leviathan. So like Tikhon Mirov, and unlike Hobbes, the Earl of Clarendon was a sincere Christian, and he also objected strongly to the sort of tyranny of the king over the church and over the Christian subject that Hobbes sets up in the Leviathan. And he also distinguishes between Hobbes's absolutism and legitimate monarchical rules. That might be another interesting parallel for our listeners to pursue when thinking about whom to compare Tikhon Mirov to in the English tradition.
I think
Anyway,
certainly,
go ahead. Yeah.
sorry, I think certainly Tikhon Mirov would agree with him that the tyranny of the king over the church was a bad thing. I mean, it's something that Tikhon Mirov himself certainly thought. I mean, his view was that there should be a reciprocal influence of the monarch on the church and the church on the monarch, and there shouldn't just be a one-way traffic, which it could well be, as you say, under Hobbes's system. But it's interesting that you mentioned Clarendon. It's not a person I've focused on very much. So yeah, thanks for that.
I think not too many people focus on Clarendon today. I muted myself. Let's go on to the next question. So, like Konstantin Leontief, Tikhon Mirov was also a defender of the estates. And as you note, the emphasis of these two thinkers is quite different. So, for Leontief, if I'll give my own summary here. For Leontief, the estates were crucial in preserving culture. These social orders, such as the clergy, the nobility, the peasant communes, the guilds, all shaped the characters of individuals, imbuing them with different ideals, different codes of conduct, different regional and cultural characteristics. So, on the one hand, the estates preserve the diversity of human types within a nation. And this contributes to what Leontief calls the poetry of life. The estates also prevent human beings from degenerating into masses of generic human beings, into the most boring type of human being, the Nietzschean last man or the global consumer, who debase everything holy, noble, or beautiful with their banal tastes and pursuits. So that was Leontief's main concern with the estates, as far as I can see. Leontief even says that the estates are more important than the monarchy. Now, Tikhon Mirov's interest in the estates is maybe not incompatible with that, but his focus is quite different. So, could you tell us about what was Tikhon Mirov's main interest in restoring the estates?
No, you're right. Tikhon Mirov's interest was primarily political. I mean, you're also right. I think that Europe is approaching a crisis in democracy, or maybe in the middle of a crisis of democracy now, actually. But it was in a crisis of democracy in 1880 anyway, because I think 1888, I think, there was the Panama scandal in France when a lot of people lost a lot of money in the collapse of the Panama Canal Company. And it was found that many members of the French Parliament had their fingers in this particular pot. And it was a great scandal. And it certainly influenced Tikhon Mirov to, it made him detest what he called the democracy of vote counting, where, as you say, he just saw the people as fodder, as lobby fodder, who were being endlessly deceived by rogues, basically. Now, I mean, I don't think Europe's going to move away from vote counting anytime soon. I mean, if we have a change in the UK, it's going to be one which means that the will of the people, if you like, is more adequately represented than it is at the moment. But I think that the parliamentary system will remain. One of the reasons for this is that the alternatives, such as Tikhomirov puts forward, of a system where you don't have elections as we know them, but you have representatives of all sections of society, whether it's landowners, farmers, industrialists, trade unions, educationalists, you name it, they all get the best representatives of all these people, he said, should come together and advise the Tsar on what needs to be done in any particular sphere at any particular time. And that way, the Tsar will receive the views of the people undiluted through what the other thing he hated was what he called the firewall of the bureaucracy. So that the subject could never speak to the Tsar and the Tsar could never speak to the subject. They would both of them always be speaking to a bureaucrat. And he thought that is something that should be something should be done about that too. The problem, I think, today is that the fascist governments of the 1930s and afterwards, in some cases, have thoroughly discredited this as a form of government, particularly Mussolini. If you read some of Mussolini's writing and his advisors, Gentile, it sounds very, very similar, actually, to the ideas that Tikhomirov was being put forward. Although, on the other hand, what Tikhomirov was saying is quite similar to ideas that are being put forward in England by somebody who's now largely forgotten, called Anthony Mandela, who is now regarded as very much the father of industrial arbitration. I mean, Tikhomirov saw his revised form of government between the Tsar and the states as a means of liberating people. It was actually the polar opposite of Mussolini's and certainly Hitler's view of using it as a means of control. That was not Tikhomirov's view at all. Yes, it's worth mentioning that actually Tikhomirov wrote a lot in defense of civil society. And his view of the state was that it should be a very restricted thing. It should be restricted to those things which facilitate the working of civil society, which is to say, defense of the realm, criminal law, and a very few other things, actually. Within that framework, from Tikhomirov's point of view, people should be left to get on with their lives among themselves. So, although he was not in any way a precursor of fascism, has been sometimes suggested, I think that the phenomenon of fascism, as we've experienced it, really now means that his formula will not, I'm afraid, be acceptable. Whether it would have worked then, we'll never know, because for one reason or other, particularly Prime Minister Pyotr Stolypin would have nothing to do with it. He had his own agenda for particularly land reform, which he thought that Tikhomirov's rather revolutionary proposals would get in the way of, so they never got any real traction. But it's interesting, though, that he, in his proposals for the revival of the estates, he was very much going with the flow of ideas that were going forward as to how a better form of democracy could be developed.
I don't know. Yeah, I of course think you're right that it's unlikely that this alternative way of representing the people would be embraced today, not only because the fascists took it up and adopted it while also changing it, but also because the estates don't really exist anymore. Those corporations, those social groups have withered away, and perhaps there are new social groups, but it's a very different society today. But any case, it's a concern that I think very much also speaks to the concerns of our time. So, for instance, on 157, I'll read a little quote here. Tikhomirov posited his system of representation by the estates as a mechanism aimed at liberating the people and the creative forces in Russia from the stranglehold of the bureaucracy and forestalling its replacement by the rule of the embryonic professional political class, eventualities that were, in his eyes, equally deleterious. Right? So, and seeking some kind of alternative to bureaucracy, which stifles the people's will, and also a professional political class which develops its own distinct interests, which are distinct from the people. So his at least his attempt to try to avoid those the flaws of those forms of government through the estates is at least interesting. Something I think you're right. We didn't mention this, but it seems to me that Tikhomirov, in that respect, is like the early Slavophiles, especially Konstantin Aksakov, who thought that as you said before, that there is a separation between public and private, and the scope of power of the monarchy has some limits and should allow some space for civil society to emerge and to express its will to the monarch in an unmediated way. So that I think it's an interesting collection of ideas on that point.
I think one of the best reasons for reading about Tikhomirov actually is that if you think about the stranglehold of the professional political class and the stranglehold of the bureaucracy, these are things I think are very familiar to many of us today, certainly in Europe. And when, even though Tikhomirov's solution might not be practical, his thinking about it certainly stimulates. Today, it's as re a lot of what he says actually on terrorism too is as relevant today as it ever been, and he's well worth investigating. Yes.
So let's go on to the next topic. So I mentioned earlier that both Konstantin Leontief and Lev Tikhomirov predicted the emergence of totalitarian socialism in the 20th century and foresaw even many of the particulars of the Stalinist regime. And we didn't talk about this in our last episode on Leontief, but the last two chapters of your book on Leontief are entitled The Feudalism of the Future and the Red Tsar. And I'm going to read some of your quotes from Leontief's letters in which he makes such predictions. This is on page 187 of the book about Leontief. So these are Leontief's words. I am of the opinion that socialism in the 20th and 21st centuries will start to play that role in the sphere of government and economics, which Christianity used to play in the sphere of government and religion in the days when she began to triumph. Men will never consent to live without religion. Socialism by no means equates to atheism. And then another line here. And in Leontief's eyes, there is a further parallel between the rise of socialism and the rise of Christianity. Socialism, this is a quote, socialism is now in the stage of martyrdom and its earliest congregations scattered here and there, but it will find its Constantine. What is now the doctrine of revolution will then be the apparatus of repression, the instrument of extreme compulsion, discipline, perhaps even of slavery. Socialism is the feudalism of the future. And that's just one example of, again, I would recommend that our readers read the book and read that entire chapter. Now, I think Tika
Could
Mirov. Go
I
ahead,
just
go.
break in? Could I recommend to your readers that they read a very short extract by Herbert Spencer, the 19th century English philosopher? He wrote a book called The Man Versus the State. And in that, there's a chapter called The Coming Slavery. And Leontief drew heavily on that. He was very impressed by it. So I think it's worth reading that in tandem with Leontief, actually, on this particular topic.
Very good. All right, so I think Tikhon Mirov, we've heard at least a snippet of Leontief's prediction. Tikhon Mirov gives a much deeper analysis of revolutionary socialism in his last major work, The Religious and Philosophical Fundamentals of History, and the essays also in the essays on the Antichrist. So could you give our listeners a taste of those arguments?
Well, the Religious and Philosophical Fundamentals of History is a vast book. But actually, it's a very cleverly written book. And he draws, there's a central distinction he draws throughout it, basically. It appears at first to be, well, it is a defense of the Judeo-Christian tradition of revelation versus the various forms of paganism. His suggestion, his belief, is that the Mosaic revelation is the only true one because it is the only one that can be thought of as coming direct from God, whereas all alternative revelations and religions stemming from paganism. Through its various manifestations of polytheism, pantheism, Tikhon Mirov says, are clearly the products of the human mind, whereas the Judeo-Christian revelation is the product of God's mind. Now, why does he say this? It's the cornerstone of his argument is the theory of creatio ex nihilo, or creation from nothing. He says it's an idea which the human mind could not have developed independently. It had to be handed down from divine mind because it's only God's mind who could comprehend this idea anyway. All the others, he says, are all pagan religions, right down to the most refined, the Greek one, still cling to the idea that nothing comes from nothing. And that all you see is transformation, and the divinity, should the divinity exist, is either part of creation or a manifestation of creation. It's not. It does not stand outside of it. Now, why does he go on like this so at such length? It's because he sees the Christian tradition. Leading down through the Roman Caesarism to Byzantinism to Moscow and eventually to the Romanov dynasty in Russia as being a development of the Christian idea whereby Roman absolutism metamorphosed into Byzantine theocracy, and this reached its apogee in Russia as the Third Rome. Whereas paganism developed into pantheism, and then found that pantheism equated to the no God, because if everything's God, nothing is God. And then it became atheism. People became discontented with atheism. They cannot give up the idea of a God, but there is no transcendental God. So who's left? Man becomes God, as Feuerbach said, as Nietzsche said, and as I think earlier you said, with regard to Robespierre. And in fact, he developed the idea of man godhood, that man would be elevated to God's place. He even took it a stage further and said that man may elevate himself to God's place, but he's not God, so he's not equal to the task. So he then finds an ally in Satan. So the final development, which started in paganism, becomes Satanotheism, as he called it, the rule of Satan. And that, he said, led to the disaster of Bolshevism and would lead to further disasters. And he pointed the way forward, as you said, as Leontiev did, to the great dictators of the 20th century. And in fact, the very last thing he wrote, you mentioned earlier, this is Eschatological Fantasy, is a rather interesting book because it clothes this whole idea in quite a short story, in a kind of almost science fiction way. It's a curious book. It steals a march on things that have been and written much more recently. But there's no doubt that he had this prophetic vision, and Leontiev had this prophetic vision, and it did unfortunately come to pass.
All right, so a final question for today. In the introduction on to your book on Tikhomirov, you say that Tikhomirov belongs to a triad of major figures in conservative thought in Russia that includes also Konstantin Leontiev and Vasily Rozanov. So are these first two books part of a trilogy? Will your next book be on Rozanov, perhaps?
Well, it's an idea, although I have to say, Rozanov is daunting in the sheer volume of his output is rather daunting. And actually, there's been a very good book written about him not so long ago. I couldn't quote it off the top of my head now, but it rather stole the march on that. But I'm looking at the period. I'm looking at other people, particularly the authors in Vehi. The contributors to Vehi, they're a very interesting bunch of people, and I'm sure there's a lot more mileage in this fascinating period, really between the late 19th century up to 1917. It's a period that I find quite fascinating because it's so much like has the character of a Greek tragedy, really, and you feel you're looking at a train racing towards the buffers, and you think, my God, can't somebody, put the brakes on? But of course, they didn't. And yeah, I suppose that's what makes it interesting. So yeah, I'm still looking around. I think I'll come back with another one.
Very good. So, whatever the focus is of that next book, I look forward to reading that as well. Glenn Cronin, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Ethan. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. We'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through 14th. You can still register for the conference on our website. Be sure to rate and review this podcast and share it with your friends. Please also check out our journal, Pietas. Pietas is a peer-reviewed open access journal. To submit your own work to edit the editors of Pietas, please go to our website, ciceroniansociety.org. If you like this content, please also check out our new podcast on Cicero's On Duties, led by Josh Bowman and Chris Annandale. I expect to be a guest on that podcast myself in some later episodes. Thank you for listening.